Hello, everybody. You're listening to Shop Talk Show. This week is sponsored by Environments for Humans, who have some upcoming conferences, the RWDSummit.com and InControlConference.com, both of which are going to be super cool and me and Dave will be at. Also, Squarespace and the new Squarespace 6 platform. Go to squarespace.com/shoptalk for a discount. So you know they came from us. It's a super cool platform for building websites. But we'll talk about that later. For now...
Talk episode 30 with me, Dave Rupert, and my co-host, Chris.
You started
Goyer.
Out with a weird voice, and we just kept it going. Hi, everybody. My name's Chris. I'm also Dave's co-host on the Shop Talk Show. And this week we have Rebecca Murphy. Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'm busy cracking up.
Wow. I just wanted to try something different, just a little more shock jock.
I thought maybe that was pre-recorded, and then I was like, no, this is happening. This is happening right now.
I'm working on my voice talent angle.
You know what? I feel like people that listen to podcast, you know, because this is a web dev podcast that largely, you know, is trying to fill the void that was left on Earth when jQuery stopped. Maybe that's it. I just thought of that.
You just went right there, didn't you? Just like right there.
Are those the heartstrings?
They are. You're tugging at them right now.
Oh, that's too bad. But I'm sure most people remember it anyway. So what was the, why did that, is this just because you guys are just, you're too good at JavaScript to be podcasting anymore? Like your time is in demand that it just wasn't worth it?
It was lots of things. Like for one, Paul got the job at Google and moved across the country. So there was that. And then you had people across three different time zones. Me and Adam were on the East Coast. And so there's that. And I think also like, jQuery is still, of course, popular and huge, and everyone uses it, but the focus of front-end development has shifted away from, like, ooh, check out this jQuery plugin.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, it was fun, and, like, I still hum the little music all the time. it's still online, too, and there's lots to learn from it, but I think that, that the focus of the front-end world has shifted.
Yeah, is it like that's an interesting topic, kind of. Is it kind of like, oh, who cares what you use for a DOM manipulation library? The bigger question is about, like, how do you structure your app and stuff? And jQuery doesn't even care about that, right?
Or is that? It's like you've read a blog post that I wrote or something.
Maybe. Huh. Or maybe your ideas are like, beyond even your blog, and you've set the pace for the world's opinion.
I want to say, Rebecca, I heard you talk and you said, like, jQuery is the select a bunch of crap and do stuff model of JavaScript. Is that right?
I don't know if I said that. Was I drinking? Because I might have said it that way.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. Probably not. I think if this was a TXJS, then I was not drinking at 9 in the morning. So, for the record. No, I mean, jQuery is like, that's its whole point is get some elements and do something with them. And that is useful in a set of circumstances. And it's even useful in large applications sometimes. But the days of like, that's what we're using JavaScript for, I would like to think those days are getting behind us. That doesn't mean jQuery will stop being useful, just it's a very small piece of a very big picture now.
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And so, And then what do you, like, your job is?
My job is, I just started working for Boku, which is a consulting company up in Boston, and also a huge focus on open source. We've got, like, Ben Allman, who's the who created Grunt. We've got Tim Brannion, who's working on Backbone and Backbone Boilerplate, and Rick Waldron, who's done Popcorn.js and all sorts of other stuff. So lots of focus on open source up there. And I'm working a lot right now on helping to develop the JavaScript training curriculum. And I'm working really closely with Jory Burson, who's the director of training there. And we've hopefully, fingers crossed, got some good stuff in store, just fleshing out that training curriculum.
Mm, juicy. So unreleased, you heard it here first, web training.
you heard it here first.
We sure. are breaking news podcast.
Cutting edge right here on this podcast. Okay.
Great. So Rebecca's the name and JavaScript is the game.
Yeah. Pretty much. You've been working on that one for a while, haven't you?
I did. I woke up this morning with a sparkle in my eye. We got a little bit of hot drama to cover, and then we will jump into question and answer by all you people. Ooh. Dave, do you have something?
Well, I just wanted to point out we're always looking for feedback. We got a lot of feedback recently about how bad the audio is on some of our past episodes, and we're working on that. But I wanted to point out a really nice review that was over at Nice Web Type, and I'm just going to read a quote. He said, "Shop Talk, a sound effects podcast that also covers web development topics." And just really thanks to Tim Brown over at Nice Web Type.
We should have Tim Brown on. Don't you feel like he deserves one of your best?
Oh, yeah. Well, and then he polished it off with
Waka, 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 waka. Hey, waka, waka. Ah, waka, waka, waka.
So,
I like how long that one is.
I know. I should probably get a shorter version. But, so I just thought that was basically sums up the podcast. And that's how I'm going to start introducing it. that's all I got.
We should get Tim Brown on. Okay. Here's some hot drama that just came out yesterday, I think. So CSS is going to have variables in it, and the spec was like a function. It was like var parentheses and then the name of it or something. And then there was var dash too. There's a couple of different like syntaxes you could do it. And then even in the spec, there was $ variable name, which is similar to how less in SAS does it or how SAS does it. Less uses a ampersand, I think, or something. Yeah, I think it's an ampersand and less. Anyway. It was like everybody likes the dollar sign everybody in school likes the dollar sign because it's just a nice way to, it's like PHP or I don't know. It just makes sense to, okay, dollar sign thing. That's a variable. And that was dropped from the spec. So now the only way to declare a variable is like a little bit of a longer form way to do it.
Yeah. I was just reading this morning. Am I butting in? Am I allowed to talk?
No, please.
This is my job. All right. I was just reading this morning because it was on Hacker News, and of course that's where I get all my news, right? And the whole rationale was like we might need the dollar sign for something cooler later. Yes. I guess that's the logic. I just read this morning, so I don't know what I think.
No.
But I think that syntax is pretty gross. It's like var dash foo to declare foo, and then. Var parentheses.
Right, but what if you need var dash to do something cool later?
Since when do we declare variables with var dash? Like, what is that? I don't know.
CSS is all about the prefixes.
It reminds me of source set and how weird that is.
It's not a property. Like, sure, we use dashes in property names, but like, it's not a.
I'm sure Tab would have a lot to say about this because this is Tab Atkins' blog article that explains why the droppage. And number one, I like Tab. Number two, I like that Tab blogs about these things in English so that he's yes. like the face of this thing so that we know what their decision was. And it's like one of the only places where we get this kind of direct information. And three, he did link up a discussion on one of those gross mailing list board things that just – are unbelievably hard to follow.
Open source, woo!
Yeah, is that...
mailing list. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, anyway, I'll write some CSS for this. Don't quote me on that. that the dollar sign could be used in selectors also. Right. Like, so you could, and that's, and like, so if using it in the selector precludes using it in a value, and that's why you had to drop it, because you could possibly do something really, really cool in selectors later. I'm almost on board with that, although I don't totally like grok the whole thing or whatever that word is that makes you seem like you understand it very well.
And I'll be honest, I don't write a lot of CSS anymore. So I am not, I kind of leave this to the people who do to fight this out, and I don't have strongly held opinions.
Of course, the SAS guys were like, OMG!
Oh my God, you're right, right. And yeah. Like, I think that, maybe save the dollar for something else, but I don't, that the syntax I saw was like, ew, it just felt like, it felt nasty. But, yeah, I do appreciate that. I really liked that there was a nicely written blog post that I could actually follow and have some smidgen of an opinion about it.
It's really interesting that they're bucking kind of against SAS or less, like the pre-existing syntaxes, which are performing really well. That's where I'm just sort of like, why are you guys reinventing a third wheel? You're the third wheel in this operation.
Well, I think that's the thing that makes me not get too up in arms about it, is we've already seen that SAS and LESS and Stylus will come in and fix whatever stupidity we, you know, if it ends up being stupid, we can still write SAS. We can still write LESS. We can still write Stylus and leave that nastiness under the covers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Variables is one of those things, like, it probably won't make IE10, so it might be an IE11, which is like probably 2 years after IE10. That will be the first implementation it's in. And it's one of those things where you can't just not have variables work. So we're literally talking about stuff that we probably won't be able to use in production work for like 5 years. So yeah, there's a little bit of time for this thing to settle down, guys.
Yeah, I think that's true. I have that sort of attitude a little bit less than I used to, because I remember not that long ago thinking like, God, I'll never be able to use these cool things. And like, never comes a whole lot faster than I ever thought it would.
Yeah.
And yeah, so maybe that's because I'm getting old. Time flies, etc. I don't know.
Yeah, perhaps. And there's, you know, polyfills and stuff, right? So we don't have to wait until the actual browser, because, you know, if somebody invent some really cool lightweight polyfill, maybe we can use it sooner.
We're teaching our designers that, you know, this is not a world of pixel perfection, and so we can use these things where we need to use these things, where we can use these things where they're available.
That kind of progressive enhancement stuff, and browsers are updating faster, you know. So you're right, it may not be 5 years, don't quote me on that. Oh, Dave, do you want to introduce the next small bit of hot drama?
So we got a next little bit of hot drama, and this is kind of follow up drama, because Rebecca, you were, it mentioned on a previous episode, you got involved, tangled up into a little bit of hot drama yourself regarding a certain online publication. And its methods of how would you say telling the truth? I'm not sure. But would you like to make a statement on that?
A statement.
An official statement.
This dude posted an article on NetMag. It was full of incorrect information.
Like, Rebecca, did you know that it's slower to divide numbers than to multiply them?
That's my favorite one. That's made into some talks I've been given recently, because it's so preposterous.
Yes. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, I just want to set the stage, and then you rebut it, and it was just an epic amount of comments on the thing, and some people were like, yeah, Rebecca, set the record straight, and some people were like, have you considered the man's feelings? And, you know.
Yeah. Well, so here's my statement. I even cleared my throat. Did you like that? Here's my statement. I mean, I'm really glad that there are publications that are putting information out. I think that that's one of the neat things about this thing that we do is that it's a thing that you don't need training in to. I didn't say that, Jory. You, of course, you need training. You need lots of training from Boku. You know, you don't need formal training. You don't have to go to school to learn how to do this. Most of us didn't. And so that's really cool that there's all this information out there on the internet. And some companies have even said, wow, we can make money by putting this information out on the internet. Because there's actually demand for it. And I don't have a problem with them making money on it either. But when you start selling this information, when you start profiting from this information, I think it's really important that it be accurate. I think that there is an obligation for it to be accurate because you are establishing yourself, promoting yourself as a source of authority. And when you do that, you can't just take, you know, something that someone who's like, ooh, JavaScript, and throw it up on the internet and tweet it and call it truth.
Some journalistic responsibility.
And I came from journalism, which has a terrible reputation, of course, but like that's where I came from. And like this basic requirement for fact checking, I don't feel like they're doing it. And they come back and say, well, we would pay people to fact check, but we'd only pay them, you know, $50 an article, $20 an article or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or whatever, you know, some fairly.
And it's hard to even find anybody, right? Because email, you got people like Rebecca Murphy and they just say no because they're too busy.
Yeah, it's hard to find people. This is ultimately the problem. It's hard to find people because you're not paying them enough. If you want to pay me $1,000 to fact check an article, I'll do it.
Yeah.
But like, if you want to pay me $50 to fact check an article, like I have a 24 hours in a day. I have a job, and that is not necessarily the best way for me to be spending my time. So
it's a business model problem, really.
that's what it comes down to. Is I'm not sure that these publications can publish reliably quality content.
Yeah.
Period. The end. I'm not sure that they can because you know the guy who wrote the article. I know that Smashing Mag pays their authors. I don't know if they paid him, but I know that they pay their authors. So plausibly, the guy who wrote the article got some money for it. And then again, there's like a huge burden when you're taking money to write something. It's got to be right. And I also want to really point out that like after Smashing Mag, or I'm sorry, NetMag. Shame on me. After NetMag published this and we saw it and saw the errors, a bunch of people who get paid a lot to write JavaScript took time out of their day to write a long and detailed post about the flaws in the post. And then they got really criticized for their tone.
Yeah.
And one thing I'll say is that, like, you should have seen the tone before I fixed it, before I cleaned it up. It was raw. And the other thing I'll say is, like, when people are frustrated and people are doing this for free, when people are doing the work that the magazine couldn't be bothered to do for free, I'm going to give them a little bit of leeway to have a little bit of snark. So that is my statement made.
Thank you very much. It's tough. I think you're right on the model thing. It's tough to get the best information at the best price, you know, at the prices, you know.
When I used to work for a startup I've worked for a couple of startups that their revenue was driven entirely by page views. The end. It didn't matter about the quality of the content. And it didn't matter about the quality of the content. They just put shit out there. And, you know, that's how you end up with, like, top 100 jQuery plugins from the first week of July. They need to generate those page views. And I think that it should be okay for the community to step up and say, you know what? Nuh-uh. Like, when you publish this misinformation, it has real effects on the people working hard to create the open web.
Well, cool. Well, thank you so much. I it's rare that we have a guest who is involved in hot, hot drama then show up to talk about it. So I was, and I figured you would be, you're bold enough to take it by the horns.
I'm also going camping for the next 4 days, so I don't have to deal with whatever
follow up drama.
That's whatever awesome. Twitter says after I get off this podcast, I don't know about.
That's great. Well, cool. Well, Chris, should we jump into the meat and potatoes, the question and answer section of our podcast here?
Of course we should. We have one here from Christina S. Rebecca, this is, you know,
for Rebecca.
Do you prefer function declarations or expressions, and why? If no preference, could you please explain in what instances you use each? Is that weird? I don't know what that means.
It's okay. There's a link. I'll put it. Oh, I can't put it in the chat because I'm not in the chat. Hold on. I'll join the chat and then I'll put it in the chat. I will be totally honest. I always have to look up which one's which. So that's why I had that link open, was to remember which one's which, because I'm not
JavaScriptweblog.wordpress.com. I like when people
It's Angus Crawls, so you know he knows what he's talking about.
Okay.
But yeah, I always have to look up these names for things when it's like two things that are really close to the same but different, and now I have to talk about them. this is why I didn't take biology.
It's like when you say function foo, or you set a variable is equal to a function.
Right. You assign a possibly named function to.
And that's not even the only two options, really. You can object and stuff.
Yeah, you could assign an unnamed function to a variable. You can assign a named function to a variable. You can not assign a named function to a variable. You can return a function from a function. You can return just an anonymous function expression from a function. Anyway, I don't tend to declare functions inside of functions where either of these would be super necessary. I tend to use methods on objects. When I do this, I tend toward doing the, so like if I'm using the module pattern or something like that, and I needed some sort of private function inside of a module that I'm going to return, then I'll tend to use the anonymous function expression and assign it to a variable. And the reason I do that is because I do my variable declarations at the top of my function. And so if you do a named function expression, the chat's like going crazy. If you do a named function expression just somewhere in your function, hoisting will hoist that declaration up to the top of your function, whether you wanted that or not, like whether you knew that was going to happen or not. And so I prefer to assign an anonymous function to a variable, because then I do that at the top of my function. It's very clear then that this is where this function is getting defined. I'm not going to redefine it later. If I do redefine it later, I'm redefining the variable, not the function. Because hoisting can be confusing and can lead to unintended consequences, especially if you're creating a function inside an if statement or something like that, or inside an if and an else, things can get really nasty and not what you think they are. So, yeah, I like to assign my functions to variables at the top of the enclosing function.
But doesn't that, it lends itself to better structure doing it that way, don't you think?
I think it just, it's like this, the same reason that you don't declare variables in an if statement. It's not that you can't. It's not that it won't work. It's that to someone reading the code or reading the code at a glance, it's a little bit more clear what's going on, what your intention was. You don't declare variables. You tend not to declare variables inside of an if statement, even though you can. Because that might suggest to a future reader that there's block scope in JavaScript, which there's not. So, yeah, that's my
That was an excellent answer. Christina, you got it from somebody who understands what that question meant.
I hope when I listen to that again, what I just said makes any
it's
sense.
Be like butter.
Wow. I tend to, if somebody asks, do you prefer A and B, there's a chance I understand neither of those concepts. They're like, do you, you prefer say, like, promises and deferreds or long pulling? And I'm like, I will talk.
Oh, I could answer that one. But no, I mean, I really do. I have to, with questions like this, I often have to look stuff up just because I'm not good at the trivia. And I think that's okay that I'm not good at I tell myself it's okay that I'm not good at the trivia. Like, what we do isn't about like how well you can
the job, you know? Like, I always think that's funny. Like, the best developers I know are like constantly on Google looking like how to make a for loop up. But then, you know, but then if you like try to get a job at Google, they're like, what? Please rearrange these things with a bubble sort that is backwards or, you know, and you're like, I can't do that without Google.
Right.
So you don't get the job, and then
something about linked lists. I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely some linked lists.
Definitely some linked lists.
Let's do one more, and then a sponsor.
Yeah, yeah. So this one's from Vlada Stankovic, and it's wrote in saying, in highlight of your recent blog post, a baseline for front end developers. Do you believe that JavaScript as a language is currently at its peak? What are your thoughts about JavaScript's future?
Well, that's not complicated or anything.
Okay. So what is your blog post about? Maybe let's start.
Yeah, let's start.
So a baseline for front-end developers was about just kind of how knowing HTML and CSS and a little bit of jQuery would get you places a few years ago. And I think now it's a lot more about knowing a larger ecosystem that includes a lot more tools, like build tools, like dependency management, like SaaS, like, you know, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not enough to just be able to edit some HTML and CSS and jQuery and
FTP. Which means that JavaScript has gotten a lot more popular. So that why would we think it's at its peak? You know,
I don't think it's at its peak. I think that it is still a very exciting place. And I think that, you know, it could be that in 6 or 12 or 18 months, something else comes out of the blue and just, like, JavaScript's over.
Google Dart.
These
have to be built into so many different browsers, you know? Like, if we're not talking about it now yet, the chance of it all of a sudden, replacing it would be weird.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, JavaScript is the most installed language. Like, it is on every consumer computer, which you should, like, that's not true about any other language. And so I think that there's a good future ahead for JavaScript. I think for JavaScript developers, like, maybe this is an interesting part of this question. JavaScript developers, because JavaScript is becoming a more serious language, and because, you know, ES6 is going to introduce some concepts that are much more computer science-y. I think that what you're going to see is that more traditional developers are going to be gravitating towards JavaScript and away from other traditional server-side languages. They're at least going to need to know JavaScript a lot better. I think we're already seeing that like the knowledge that community is bringing is very different than the knowledge that the typical front-end developer who knew HTML, CSS, and then got introduced to JavaScript. That's the transition that I think we're seeing right now, is JavaScript's becoming more serious and the developers working on it are more traditionally experienced than the developers who used to be. And it's interesting because those traditionally experienced developers, they haven't worked in a browser environment before where, like, all bets are off. And so the front end developers have a lot to teach them about the unpredictability of that environment. But the traditional developers have a lot to teach the front-end developers about architecture and memory management and those sorts of things.
Yeah. God, that sounds fun. It sounds like we're like, I don't know. It sounds very like Zen or like what's that little symbol with the little sperm swimming around each other?
Yin and yang.
Yes.
If you could see me, I'm making little wavy signs right now.
I like that.
Let's do it. Let's do. Yeah. Okay. So one of our sponsors this week. Thank you for coming on for a couple of shows here. Squarespace. Their new platform, Squarespace 6, is very nice. I wrote a blog post about it on CSS Tricks that it was just kind of like talking about sea changes and stuff. You know, we were just talking about JavaScript, and it's like it's changing, and it's getting bigger, and more people are working on it. It's the most installed thing in the world. It's just, you know, things, technology kind of changes, and it kind of what I ended up with in the post is saying that I think front-end design is kind of going to change a bit, too, and I posted up image of a simple-looking website, and it was like, how many times has this simple-looking website been coded from absolute scratch from web developers? Like this, it must be just like hundreds of thousands of times that someone looked at this design and be like, gotta code this thing up. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's a column, float left. Here's a list item. I better make that color white text decoration underline nothing. And it's just been, I think, and I kind of hope that someday front end development kind of moves beyond writing code over and over and over and over, you know?
Well, and I think that we're like Twitter Bootstrap is the first like serious attempt at that, or the first attempt at that I've taken seriously. Like, it's not just that they have an implementation of all of these design patterns, but it's that they have declared a vocabulary for all of these design patterns. And that's exciting to me, because once you agree on that vocabulary, once you agree that this is how we make a sidebar nav, like this is the markup that we use for that. And maybe you like how Twitter Bootstrap marks that up. Maybe you don't, but like, I think that's the next thing to happen in front end implementation is some sort of agreement around that. Because once you agree on that, then you can develop tools around that. Then, you know, making a new site is about styling these predictable elements rather than inventing it from an empty body tag, which is, that's insane that we're still doing that. What?
It kind of is, because back-end developers don't do that very often.
Right.
But here's the thing about Bootstrap, which I really like and is amazing work and is just kind of – it's cooler than people even think it is. Even if you're sick of it and you're like, oh, all buttons look the same now, you got to appreciate the level of quality that went into this thing. Because it came out right when I was working on a design pattern library, and I was like, oh, dang, theirs is way better.
So as a designer, you're like, grumble, grumble, this all looks the same. What about the user?
Yeah.
Does the user, like, the part of the success of iOS is that everything looks the same, and so it's predictable. You know that this pattern means this thing. And so I don't know if I believe what I'm saying, but I think it's something to think about, that yes, designers want to make new designs every single time, but is that... For an affordance like a button, is that really a good idea? I don't know.
I know. It's worth discussing. Gray Ghost Visuals in the chat room is saying design is not a commodity, but little design things like a little button might be a commodity. But how and why you use the button and what text can be in the button, that's all part of design too, and that can be specific. Use your fancy brain as a designer to come up with that stuff, but the usability of the button itself might be a commodity. Anyway, I was talking about Squarespace, and I was saying, so you have to be extra at this point in order to use Twitter Bootstrap. You have to be even nerdier than a day one developer. Like, it's a step the other direction. It's like this makes development more complicated in a way. As far as day one, it might make it simpler for people who are, you know,
but day one, yeah, totally. Day one developers, it's harder. Not where you start. Yeah.
But day one people might be able to start on Squarespace. People might be able to say, hey, let's not reinvent the wheel on this template. Let's pick one of their awesome templates. Let's just focus on the content. Let's change around a few things. Let's drag and drop some modules around, making web design as easy as it probably should be. It just happens to not be because it's complicated right now. But I think tools like this kind of self-service, design your own website kind of things are kind of the future and can, or at least inform the future of web design. Like, what if there was a browser? What if there was a built-in browser-based module for like horizontal navigation? You could, the nav tag wasn't just a semantic tag, but it did stuff. Like, mm-hmm. a drop-down navigation was baked into the browser because it was decided that this was the best way to handle that. That kind of thing is awesome. And anyway, Squarespace, you know, not only does you go first.
No, you go. You're talking about a sponsor, and sponsors are important. So you talk.
They kind of are, and it's. And I just wanted to wrap it up, and we can keep talking about this. But I think you know they do a good job with this. They have good templates. They help a lot of people. Stop making a photo website for your buddy. You know, from scratch, because they'll be happier for you if you just use something where they can have control. And anyway, let's talk about the future a little bit more. Thanks, Squarespace, for sponsoring. Go to shopsquarespace.com/shoptalk, which either works for the code automatically, or when you check out, you shoptalk 8 for 10% off anything that you buy from them.
For life. That's for life. 10% off your website.
Well, it's kind of for life. It's like if you buy a year, you get 10% off the whole year. You can then use it again or whatever. But if you choose to just go monthly, then it would just be the first month. But you save double if you go the year. It's cheaper and you save another 10% off of it. But
I totally interrupted your sponsor talk with talk about Twitter Bootstrap, but like I do agree that like I had a friend who's starting a new business, like non-technical business, and she was talking about making her website, and she was like fighting with WordPress and you know, wow, this HTML stuff, I've done it before, but I forgot how like picky it is and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, that was what you did 5 years ago. That's not what you do now, because all of these great tools have come out, and like, yay standards, because that makes all of these great tools more possible that, you know, you were trending toward standards where things behave more and more the same.
I would say like, if it worked out, you know, like if we were working with a client and they're like, we need an internal web page that works on everything, I would have like zero problems using Twitter Bootstrap or like Chris, your example with the photographer, you know, somebody who just needs a simple website. Like it's either me like writing some crufty WordPress plugin for them, or it's like, you know, just using Squarespace and
like, it's already done.
Yeah. I need to get over myself is probably what it is. I just need to like start putting people on it and say like, call me back when that stops working. But I think it's gonna work for you.
Hey.
Yeah. What were you saying? Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I think we're all agreeing with each other.
Next.
Okay, cool. Next question.
Yes.
This is an audio one from Cameron, and it's pretty good. I think it's interesting, and here we go.
Hello, Shop Talk Show. I have a question about GitHub etiquette. I recently found a little bug in somebody's jQuery plugin. It was like a really simple thing to fix. It was they had just used jQuery's dollar sign without protecting it against conflicts with other libraries. So a simple bug, but a really important one, and it was causing the whole thing to not work in Drupal and probably lots of other places. So anyways, I did what I thought I was supposed to do. I forked the repository, I patched the bug and committed the changes, and then I submitted a pull request, my very first ever pull request. I was very proud. And anyways, it's been about a week now, and I haven't seen any sort of reaction to that from the owner of the repository. So I'm wondering if there's some step that I skipped there, or if there is some sort of best practices or best patterns for contributing to somebody's project like that. And also in general, just what's some of the etiquette around GitHub, and how can I be sort of a good and productive member of this community? So anyways, thank you very much for the show, and I appreciate your answer. Bye.
Okay, thanks, Cameron, for calling in. For what it's worth, he could be talking about one of my points. I'm just crap house at merging pull requests.
Well, he's saying he made a very legit pull request, and the person either is ignoring them or may, you know, disagree with that. They're like, oh, that's ugly, I don't like that. Once in a while, me and Dave get one on FitVids.js, and they're like, oh, here, dude, don't worry about it. We made this work with SuperVids fitfit.zzz.com. Don't worry about it. I just forked it, and now your Fitbits works with that. And we're like, thanks a ton for your pull request, but like, we have a way that it can work with that without putting that into core. And like, sometimes we don't even have time to respond exactly to why we're not taking that pull request. Isn't that relevant?
Yeah. So I have like my own opinions, but I'd love to hear Rebecca's. Like,
yeah, I think that I also have some projects out there, and. It's the same sort of thing. Like, I often will miss pull request emails, and it's not until I go visit the project 2 weeks later that I'm like, oh shit, where'd this come from? And so it could just be inadvertent oversight. But I would say that Cameron has done everything right. Like, that's exactly what you're supposed to do. Identify an issue, fork the repo, make a branch, make the change, make a pull request. Maybe the only thing that you left out is like make a test, but I, you know, I don't know if this plugin has tests to begin with or a whole testing framework. So that's like the only other thing that you might do is make a test to prove that your change works. But I would maybe just on the pull request, make a comment and at the repo owner, and just, you know, ping them again, or maybe they're in the jQuery channel on IRC, or maybe you can find them on Twitter and just, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, because we're all busy people and we all get way too much email, and just say, hey, wondering if you've had a chance to take a look at this, because this sounds totally legit. Like, it's not like what you were talking about, Chris, where it's like, oh, I totally butchered your plugin in order to make it work on my site.
Right.
Yeah. I think, yeah, like what you're saying, I just think like be nice and be patient are like the big two rules there. Also,
yeah, assume the best. Assume that this is not someone being an ass until they're actually an ass.
Yeah. I also get like a lot of, like, you know, there'll be a pull request and it's like, I fixed it for you. And you're just like, Whoa, what was broken? Right. Like, there's no issues. There's nothing. You're just like, what's happening? So, like,
part of GitHub etiquette is maybe letting them know that you're going to start on a pull request, but maybe, you know, would you say?
I would love it if people like filed an issue and said, hey, I noticed this doesn't work and blah, blah, blah. I'm working on a fix. I'll have it within the hour or something. And I would just be like, I love you.
The only thing I don't like about that is then you end up with two issues in your repo, one for the pull request and one for the issue that was opened. And so if it's something like super trivial like that, where it's like two lines. Yeah.
Like the jQuery closure example that Cameron had. Like,
yeah. Hmm. Yeah. But on the other hand, if there's like, I'm going to write 100 lines of code, don't just submit a pull request. Talk about that first. Because the author may have, or the maintainer may have a really good reason why you shouldn't do that.
Indeed. Next.
Yeah.
Next.
Next. All right. This one comes from Pat O'Callaghan, and he's asking, after reading your blog post, A Baseline for Frontend Developers, you're getting so much press here this week. I've decided to take the plunge into writing tests for my JavaScript, but as I've never been exposed to writing JavaScript tests before, I'm not sure I'm doing it right. I tend to write all my modules using the revealing module pattern, which is a thing, I think, and only exposing init functions for the ones that need to be called externally. But how can I test the internal functions of my objects? Do I have to ditch revealing module pattern altogether and expose all my functions? Also, this is a bit of an open-ended question, but what is your process for writing tests? Hopefully that made sense to everyone. So he uses this revealing module pattern, which has basically init. So you say my plugin.init, and that'll run the plugin in its entirety, or his module, whatever he's doing. So,
doesn't have a lot of public methods for testing, is the point, right?
Yeah. So if you tried to be like, test my plugin dot Ninja Town, it wouldn't work or whatever.
I want a Ninja Town method. My plugin. What does that do?
Mostly just removes things.
It's boring. Yeah. So this is a really good question, because in JavaScript, like that, those are kind of your two choices. You can expose functions, and then because we can't protect methods on an object, consumers of that object could totally overwrite those methods, make them do something completely different. And this is like the beauty of JavaScript and the terrifying thing about JavaScript. So if you really want to protect something private and make sure that no one else can interfere with it or call it or anything like that, then you have to close it inside of a function. You know, define a function inside of a function, and then that function is only accessible inside the function, unless you expose it using the module pattern or something. So there's no answer here that makes me happy. What I actually do is I return out of, if I'm using the module pattern or if I'm using AMD modules or something like that, then what I actually do is if I want to be able to test something, then I have to return it. And I'll name that method using an underscore as the first character, which is a signal to the other friendly consumers of whatever this thing is I'm creating. It's a signal to them, don't count on the presence of this. Don't count on, don't use it directly. And don't mess with it or stuff's going to break. But it's just a signal. It's just a convention. It's not, it doesn't stop them from doing anything. Of course, in ES6, I guess we'll get, or ES5, I can't remember which one's which, not in any current reality we live in the browser, but,
that means like the spec or whatever for, yes, for JavaScript. When you see ACMI, it kind of just means like which version of JavaScript.
Yes. So in future JavaScript, we will be able to say, this is a public, but protect, this is a public method, but you can't mess with it. You can't override it. You can't change the definition of it, but we can't do that now.
Fancy.
So what I end up doing is anything that I want to be able to test, I expose. And I think that it's important to test that. I mean, you could test, you know, when I init my module, do these 50 things happen? And that's kind of crappy to do that. That doesn't really, if anything goes wrong or some edge case or something, whatever, it's going to be hard to spot, and it's going to be hard to know where things went wrong. So Ben Cherry has a really good post about this. If you Google writing testable JavaScript, Ben, I hope I got that right. Now I'm looking. He has a good post about this that kind of spells out the problems that you have to deal with. I'm also going to be giving a training in September about writing testable JavaScript at Boku, and we'll be talking about this, but I'll be saying much the same thing that I just said, that for now your best option is to just expose those methods.
That's cool. I wonder if you could, I don't know, I wonder if there's some like add-on or something you could do, like make them public temporarily. And then, like, in production, they're not public.
You could probably do some interesting, you know, build time rearranging of stuff. Probably you could. As for what I'm doing for JavaScript testing, I have fallen absolutely in love with Mocha. It makes me very happy. I'm using Mocha and... I was using Expect.js. I've also been playing with Chai, and then I've been automating all of it with Grunt. So just at the command line, you just run Grunt Mocha, and it just runs your tests in Phantom.js for you. Phantom.js is a headless webkit, so you don't get full coverage of all the browsers, but you don't have to fire up your tests in a browser and look at them with your eyes. You can just run it in the command line, and it spits out, like, 32 assertions passed.
Fancy.
Yeah. So
Cool. Let's do our longtime sponsor, Environment for Humans. They do lots and lots of conferences. They do online conferences, one of which coming up is the Responsive Web Design Summit. It's a one-day banger all about responsive web design. I'll be at, I think, Dave, are you doing this too?
I'll be there.
Me and Dave are both doing it. RWDSummit.com. You can save 20% off the cost of that conference with the coupon code SHOPTALK. So who doesn't want to learn about responsive web design? You don't have to get on a plane to go anywhere. You can do it right there in your place. If you're trying to convince your office to do it, they have passes where you can like pay for the pass or like for your whole office, and you can all sit on a couch in a room or whatever, or little uncomfortable chairs as most offices have, and all watch together if you want. That's a cheap way for a company to attend a conference all together of really modern cutting edge stuff. RWDSummit.com. They also have In Control conferences coming up in Hawaii. Both me and Dave will also be at that one. You can also save $100 off that one with coupon code SHOPTALK. So Environments for Humans, thanks for sponsoring. They do great conferences. In Control Conference is a face-to-face one. It's, you know, it's it live. We're going to be there in person. Me and Dave, coconut bras, the whole deal.
And coconut then, bras?
Oh, we made a promise. Yes.
Totally going now.
We have a promise. And then
I wish we could come. I miss Rebecca. We've we never get to see each other.
Poland next year.
Well, they'll always be Poland.
Oh man.
How do you spell bra? Is it just BRA?
I think it seems like it's BRAUGH.
You've seen that there's a Flight of the Conchords where it's like, I'm pretty sure her name was Bra-Bra. And it's like, there's not even a such name as Bra-Bra. And it's like, it's Barbara. She just said it weird one time. And at the end, she's like, my name is Bra-Bra. B-R-A-H. B-R-A-H. Anyway.
Yep.
Can we do one more or two more? Do we have the time for that? Is that okay?
Yeah, let's do it.
Go for it.
You got a flight, right?
No, not till later.
Okay, let's do at least one and see where we're at. So, Chris, you want to choose it?
I will. We're totally out of order now. So somehow I managed to pick the first question of the day in the middle of our
thing. good job.
Let's see. I want to pick out a good. Let's do the other audio one. Is there, or do we do both of those?
Oh, we got one.
Is there another audio one?
Yeah, there is. Oh. Yep. Sean Dune, the second one on the list, Dave.
Okay, here we go.
Hi, guys. This is Sean from the land where the Olympics are being held at the moment. I just wanted to get your guys' opinion on using something like Adapt.js to load in CSS files for responsive design. I had a good discussion recently with some work colleagues. Some are on the fence, some are saying that we shouldn't rely on JavaScript to load in CSS because that's allowing JavaScript to define layout. I kind of understand that, but I'm kind of in flux because we're in a position where web design and development is really changing because of all these devices, and maybe we should change our thinking in that we can load a basic CSS file up front and then use something like Adapt.js to load in any viewport specific styles. So I just wanted to know what your opinion was on that. Thanks.
So Adapt.js, written by Nathan Smith, who wrote the 960 CSS grid framework. So it's kind of, he described it, but it's basically you have as JavaScript will run, detect the viewport, and then load more style sheets as it gets larger. So,
When it came out, it had a lot of scrutiny because it was like, why would you use JS to do this? That's what media queries are for. And you can, and if you're worried about media query support, there's polyfills for that. It's much more future proof smart to use just use media queries. Adapt.js doesn't do anything that a media query can't do. What's up? Why does this even exist? You're encouraging bad behavior. I feel like Nathan got some criticism like that when it came out. Would you say that? Go ahead.
The problem with that, I wasn't aware of all that happening, but the problem with that criticism is that the difference here is that this just serves supposedly just serves the right CSS, whereas with media queries, you're sending down, like,
you gotta load it all.
Everything, and the browser picks which one to use.
That's a big deal, number one. Number two, it's becoming a little bit responsive design and multi-device design, whatever you want to call it, is becoming more than styles. It's becoming more than CSS. It's becoming a lot more of like, which responsive images technique do you want to use? Which do you want to load in modules conditionally to paste based on the size? What if on mobile you're like, I don't think they really need the poll widget. That's like, you know, let's just leave that alone. That's just an example. I'm not saying don't load polls on mobile. I'm just saying you could AdaptJS gives you callbacks for those sizes. And that's where I think the big deal is. If your website is very dependent on at this size, load these modules on this side, you could use AdaptJS as kind of the framework for it and say like, oh, if the callback fires for 800 pixels wide, then Ajax in some extra stuff. That way, when it's smaller than that, that Ajax request never fires and your page, you know, remains a little bit more lightweight. I think you could use AdaptJS to do
just for that
smart stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love to see this be something that browsers were just smart about, that there was a way to say, and can you, like, if your link tag says this is for this media, will it, I don't actually, I'm.
There's a lot of
controversy about it. Yeah, it turns out most browsers, just in their desire to suck everything up.
Down, just suck everything down.
They do, and then they only use the one.
So. And there's some reasons for that. Like if all of a sudden a different media query comes into play, it will immediately have it available so that it doesn't have to re-download stuff. And then like what about iframes? Like can you guarantee that the device it's on, it never were, like what if you have a small iframe on a big thing or a big iframe on a small device? There's like things that can come up that make it smart to do it that way. Although I would agree. I think if your media query doesn't match at the time that this page runs, don't load that resource. And not only don't load the entire style sheet, but don't load anything referenced in that style sheet either. That's a big deal.
Yeah, and it would be cool to be able to give the browsers better directives about this rather than having to use JavaScript. But I think a criticism of like, oh, this is JavaScript, don't use it for presentation. Yeah. This is JavaScript doing something that the browser ought to do for you. This isn't like JavaScript making an element be wider. This is JavaScript pulling in CSS to make an element be wider. This is almost like a polyfill for a feature that doesn't exist yet. So I don't know. Also, hi, Sean Dunn. If you're the Sean Dunn who I met last year, I think you are.
Nice. I think I have a style on CodePen that's just layout.js, and it only does layout. And if you don't have JavaScript enabled, the whole site is a disaster. I used to work for Wufoo. We're a big money-making startup company. If you didn't have JavaScript enabled, there was a huge warning that said, sorry, this site just doesn't work without JavaScript. And it wasn't a big deal. You know, I feel like the days of like, you have to make everything work without JavaScript are over, and they've been over for a long time. And that's just how I think about it.
Yeah. I think it depends on the site. I think it depends on the audience. I think it depends on a lot of things. But I think that some applications, it's like you can't say, oh, you need to write an iOS app, but you can't use a line of Objective-C. Like, what? Like, this is how we write complicated things that work in web browsers. There's not another way.
If you're serving content, if you're doing journalism or something, you need people to be able to read that content. So you can't just say, oh, JavaScript only. But
sites are not created equal. Like there's not a one size fits all rule about that, I don't think.
Yeah, true. I would say I rarely, for responsive work, and I do a lot of that, I rarely need to like use JavaScript to like pull in another CSS file. The changes we make, unless you're like hyper optimizing, but like the amount of stuff we're sending to mobile is like, you know, 10 lines of code per component or something like that. It's really not too much. Like if you're like redesigning your whole site every breakpoint, then you should look into one of these things, but you can get it's not much overhead, you know. In my humble opinion, and it's all in one place. You're just dealing, you're letting CSS be CSS. I like all that. I like the purest thing. I also, check out Enhanced.js from the Filament Group. Did you mention that? But no. It's kind of like they like give you like basic and then advanced websites. So nice. It's kind of a different way to think about like your basic experience is still preserved. Your advanced one is all the CSS media queries and JavaScript and blah, blah, blah. So think about that.
Let's do one that we're super quick and we just basically say yes or no and then we'll be in, okay?
Let's
Bryce
do that.
Miller, is it okay to charge for design and development services if I'm still learning the ropes? I know I can always charge less, but if I do a less than optimal job, the quality of the web he's worried about the quality of the web as a whole decreases slightly if you do a bad job. I kind of like that sentiment. Like if I do a bad website, the mean or average of website quality worldwide goes down. Should I plan on coming back later to tweak? Okay, let's ignore all the rest of the question. Is it okay to charge for design development service if you're still learning the ropes?
Yes.
Yay.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're all learning the ropes, dude. Just because you're doing work.
Yeah. What you just said. Go on. You were saying it.
I don't know. Yeah. We're all learning a little bit. But no matter what, you're doing work. You know, like, I don't know. Like, work equals money. And you did work. So ask for money, you know?
And I think the market will price you. Like, you probably can't get away with charging $300 an hour. But the market will price you to be appropriate. And you will be mortified in a year by what you did that someone paid you money for. Like, just embrace that right now because that's the rest of your life.
Sure. And even says, should I plan on coming back later to tweak things? Sure, but charge them money when you do that too. You don't you don't owe them. You know, they paid for the basics anyway. Okay, Bryce, yes, please charge when you're learning the ropes. Let's wrap this thing up. What do you got, Dave?
I was going to say thanks, everyone, for coming out to the Talk.io chat room, TLK.io shop talk. Thank you, guys. You guys make the show happen every week, and you give us things like facts and checks and all those things. We really appreciate that. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. Check us out on – we don't have a Facebook. That's all right. And then rate us up in iTunes. Just put a little 5-star deal and click that. And
we have a 5-star review, so mostly don't wreck that. If you think we're a 4-star kind of show, just ignore what we just said.
Yeah, just ignore. We don't want your honest opinion. And then also use the word tractor beam in your review, and I will smile silently. So, and then, I think that's all I got. Rebecca, thank you so much for coming onto the show. You're a wealth of knowledge in our community. And
R. Murphy on Twitter, right?
Yes, Eli. I don't know who the other R. Murphy is.
Murph Eli.
And then is there in your website and all that, and how can people give you money?
I haven't figured out how people can give me money. People can send me Arduino things if they want to give me things. But my website is also rmurphy.com.
What was that last one? Arduino?
Arduino? We didn't talk about that at all. It's like a little microcontroller that you can program with Johnny Five, which is like you can make robots. Input,
that kind of?
You can make robots with JavaScript.
I'm feeling a nosebleed coming up, so I might have to head out soon. That's awesome. Oh my God,
well,
here it is.
Well, we'll be Rick and I will be talking about that on the internet sometime soon, so stay tuned.
Are you involved or are you just are
I'm not I'm a fan and I've committed a couple of small features, but he has made robots that like have sonar, and he's working on one that can walk, and he's doing it all with JavaScript, and it's just crazy.
Wow. All right, folks, until next time. ChopTalkShow.com.